Good morning. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 23rd, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Christy Traina. Today's session is numbered TRC 2001-01, and it's titled Ecological Theology, Stalking the Green Bible. Let's listen in.
Bibliography, a list of further reading for people who are interested. Its added benefit is that it will repel mosquitoes because something leaked on it in our luggage. So if you carry it around with you, it might keep bugs away. I don't know. But if you're interested in further reading and would like to pick one up on the way by, on the way out, please feel free to do that. Also, there are a few things on the bookstore that you might be interested in looking into. There's a whole shelf of ecology and spirituality and theology there. And there are a few things that I have ordered also specially with an eye to this week. One of them is Lester Brown's State of the World 2001. And that's a great book to get annually if you want updated on the state of the world water supply and what's happening with fossil fuels and what species issues are current. It's just a wonderful way to bring yourself up to date on environmental issues worldwide. And so that's in the bookstore. Another book that's there was compiled by a person who will actually be teaching here later this summer, whose name is Michael Schutt. And it's called Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. Now, most of you have probably heard of simple living books, simplify your lifestyle and be a happier person, etc. This is not that kind of book. What he does is gather a lot of wonderful resources from other authors and some of them written by him on the relationship between the way that we live and our impact on the world. So this is a book not just on be happier by having a less complicated life, but a book on developing a spirituality and a habit and a virtue of mindfulness about how we live in the world and connecting our daily lifestyle choices to our effect on the environment and the people around us, both in terms of justice and in terms of ecology. And it's a really inspiring book, wonderful to use for parish study groups. It's set up very nicely for that, so it's a good way for you to take a seed home and plant it in your congregation at home. A third book has nothing to do with either of these things, but is on the shelf simply because this is a great place to read a thought-provoking novel, and this is one, a book that I've used in teaching this year by Mark Salzman called Lying Awake, about a cloistered nun in contemporary urban California, and about the usefulness of traditional spirituality in the modern world, and raises all kinds of issues about that and about spirituality and medicine. Is a very friendly and quick read, and so that's there for your use too. Okay, I think it's time to start the session, so I'm letting the tape people know that we're beginning. My name is Christy Traina, and I teach at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And this session is on ecology and the Bible, stalking the green Bible, looking at what passages in the Bible people have tended to use to tell them about relations between us and the environment, and what other ones we might use to fill those out. I should also let you know that if you need hearing enhancement, there is a device available from the audiovisual people that you're welcome to pick up and bring to a session, and you should feel free to do that. And you should also know that tapes of this session and other sessions will be available for sale in the bookstore. So if you are right now missing the session next door and wish you could be bilocating, or you're going hiking this afternoon and missing a session, be aware that you can pick up the tape in the bookstore later on. One of the things that we have to realize when we approach the Bible on ecology is that there is a traditional take in Christian theology, a place you always go to start, talking about the place of humanity in creation. And that's Genesis 1. God creating the earth bit by bit by bit, each part is good. And the last thing that gets created is the human race, right? And not only are we the last thing created, but we are given a special authority over the rest of creation. And so that's where traditional accounts start in Genesis 1. We'll be picking through various books of the Bible in no particular order this morning. So I'm sorry, we're going to be flipping around a little bit. But we start, for instance, with the end of that, chapter 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." Okay, what do you think about when you hear that? What's the sort of the role of humanity here? If you just read this piece, Christians, one of the things we do wonderfully, by the way, when we want to make things simple in Christianity is we proof text. In other words, we just take a little piece and we cut it out and we say, okay, this is what tells us what we should do. So if you just were reading this passage, what would you imagine the role of humanity in creation to be?
Responsibility.
Okay. Responsibility, we're in charge over everything, right?
It's a responsibility. We have a responsibility for it. And because of man to fall from being a part of God's creation, that now we've put ourselves in a position where we're responsible.
Okay, because the earth no longer, going forward to Genesis 3, the earth no longer is so friendly to us as it might have been if we had.
Or either that or we're not as friendly to it as
right.
We should be.
Right.
And we haven't been from way back.
Right, right. But this definitely puts us in a particularly, in a unique role, right? As being the ones who need to look at the earth and figure out what to do with it, right? Other animals don't have bears don't have the responsibilities to look at this particular bush and say, "Gee, I think I ate too many blackberries from there. I better go on to the next one," right? But we do, in that sense, have a role. What else from here?
Seems that a lot hinges on the understanding of the word dominion, and sometimes it's been interpreted to mean that we sort of own it.
Right.
And can use it for our own benefit.
Right.
Without regard.
Right. Historically, it has been read that way in many periods of Christian history.
Yeah.
In fact, some of you may know in the 1960s, 1967, Lynn White wrote an article, interestingly, in Science Magazine, not in any theological journal, called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And what he argued in that article was that it's not necessarily the fault of Genesis 1, but the fault, historically, of Christian interpreters of Genesis 1, that we have, in a sense, raped the earth, because dominion has been read by Christians as the right to exploit, the right to use, the right to sort of dominate, right, over the material world. And that this really, this Christian reading of Genesis 1 is really what's gotten us into trouble with creation. Anything else that you see here in Genesis 1 that might suggest how we're to behave or might be ambiguous about how we're to behave? certainly says we're to fill it, right?
Mm-hmm.
How full is full, right? And this also has been read as permission to sort of spread ourselves over every square inch of it, right? Think of the Homestead Act, right, in the United States, or the Mormon vision. And the Mormon vision, which is only a magnification of the traditional Christian vision of the United States as the promised land. When you took American history, probably even your children and grandchildren taking American history, this idea of the push westward as sort of a march of victory, right? We're going west, we're going to conquer the whole continent, and we need to fill it up with people, and we need to fill the space. So there's this question of what dominion means, but there's obviously this special role that humans have because we are in the image of God, the Imago Dei. One of our most famous and influential theologians who's really influenced the whole of Western theology, even not just Roman Catholic, is Thomas Aquinas, and says that we participate in God's rationality. We share in God's mind. We are able to think of goals and plan and analyze and understand. We participate in the mind of God. The rest of creation doesn't consciously participate that way. It participates in the plan of God, but we have this special role which gives us a particular responsibility. Genesis 1 is a priestly text, and the terms in Genesis 1 have a root in the way that priestly authors used language. And I'm aware I have someone here who knows much more about this than I do, so I invite you to interject. But dominion comes from the word radah, the Hebrew word radah, which implies authority over, okay? Priestly authority over. And to subdue comes from kavash, which implies forcible subjugation. So there's this idea of the human being as a priest that fulfills the role of having authority over and forcibly subjugating, or at least, powerfully subjugating, right, someone inferior. So there's a hierarchical understanding that comes out in Genesis 1 because of the cultural context of the authors, who were envisioning a kind of a priestly hierarchy, a nice pyramid with people falling in line under authority. Okay? And that's the kind of authority then that human beings have in creation. We also have to remember that it doesn't come out so strongly in Genesis 1, but other places in the Pentateuch, that this is an agrarian society, but it's an agrarian society in a largely desert area, which means that creation isn't necessarily your friend a lot of the time. So there would be the sense that we do need to tame and subdue the wilderness, because lions and serpents aren't generally beings that we want to encounter, and the earth is as likely to be dry and arid and barren as it is to be fruitful and green, right? So the idea of subduing the earth, taming it, making it yield for us, is a very important idea, and we don't really want to criticize people for having it. What happens with Genesis 1, and we're going to be spending a lot more time on this than on other things, just to get you a sense of why it gets interpreted this way. The other thing that happens here is that early Christianity really sets the pattern for how this will be read. What happens in early Christianity is you get the influence of Greek thought, classical thought. And this is very different from Hebrew thought, in which things are more integrated, as we'll see in a minute. But in classical thought, you get a kind of dualistic division. And I'm sorry for using green, but it seems to be the pen with the most ink in it. And I know it's a little bit harder to see. We'll see if it does better than sort of gray, which is what's coming out of the black. There's a division in Greek thought, and you can kind of draw a line with pairs on either side of the line. And on the upper side of the line, you have spirit and sort of divinity, and down here you have matter. Now, This is all kinds of stuff. This includes the entire non-human world. This includes our bodies. Okay, everything down here. And then up here you might have redemption and sin and temptation. These things all occur in pairs, but in each case, one member of the pair is superior to the other. Okay, you have life here, you have death and decay down here. Okay, you have obviously good up here and evil down here. You have male and female. And you have light and dark. This is very influential in John's gospel and in Paul's writings. Okay, so you have all of these pairs, these opposed pairs, but in each case you have one up, one down. Okay, this comes from what's called a Neoplatonic worldview. What happens in the Neoplatonic worldview is that God is the source of all truth, all light, all goodness. God is so good that God could not possibly directly create matter, because matter is problematic. And how could you associate an entirely good deity with something that's sort of squishy and smelly, right? So you can't. So in Neoplatonic thought, the idea is that God emanates or creates sort of sub-gods. And then the sub-gods create the earth. And by the time the sub-gods get done creating, it's mostly this and just a little spark of that, right? And human beings also are mostly matter with just a little spark of spirit. So the idea is for human beings to get out of here as quickly and cleanly as possible to get back to there. So right away you see that there's a devaluation of the body, a devaluation of the world around us, a devaluation of animals. They are for us to use while we are trying to get back. Okay? This worldview really strongly influences early Christianity, really strongly influences the New Testament, especially the Johannine writings and the Pauline writings. Okay? And you know how much those have formed us as Christians, and especially the Pauline writings formed us. I shouldn't say us, I'm Roman Catholic, but I'm married to a Lutheran, forms the Lutheran point of view, right? And there's this very subtle devaluation of matter as not quite being of God, not quite pure. And this really influences, if you read Genesis 1 through that frame of reference, very quickly dominion over is dominion over something inferior by nature, not just lower than us on the organizational pyramid, but something really inferior. Okay. The other thing about that is, this is just a little side note for those of you who might be interested in things like liberation theology. The other piece of this is that in the West, we tend to value culture over nature. We value history over nature. And so if we're talking about salvation history, we're talking about the history of God active in the human community, right? God in Exodus, right? God in the Incarnation. God in particular human historical events. And that's the frame through, that's where we look for God to be active as a Christian community, is in history, not in the stuff around us. And so we're sort of programmed to think that way. And we need to be careful, too, because when we're thinking of social justice, liberation theology, that also has tended to take the culture is better than nature frame of reference. And that's a place to criticize it. Okay. So we've got Genesis 1 and the promised land and manifest destiny and all those things that encourage us to spread out and take over. Humanity is really at the center here. I wonder if someone could read for us Psalm 8. Let me see if we want to read the whole thing. Because if we read all of everything, we'll be here too long. Yeah, that one's a shorty. Could someone read Psalm 8? This is another reinforcer of Genesis 1.
I'd be happy to.
Sure, thanks.
O Lord, our sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and infants, you have found a bulwark because of your foes to silence the enemy and the avenger. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? Yet you have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under their feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. O Lord, our sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth.
Okay. You've put us over everything. You are great. So this is God's design. Okay? You have the image of God, but then what does dominion mean? If we just read Genesis 1 and Psalm 8, we can really turn dominion into whatever we want. The wonderful thing about the Bible is we need to read the whole thing, right? And by the way, if any of you are interested in pursuing this a little more, I've written up on the board, Theodor Hebert has written lots of great stuff on ecology and the Old Testament and ways of reading it. And I'd encourage you to look into his articles and books if you want more of this kind of thing, because he's very good on these readings. We only have to go to Genesis 2 to get something different. Okay. In Genesis 2, what kind of image of the human being do we have? Here. What's going on?
Well, it's created, it's created out of matter. It's on the bottom half.
Right. Right. Right away, the human being is created out of this, of matter, and the same matter that the rest of the beings in creation are created from, right? Not only that, many of you, because people who come to Holden tend to know these things, many of you may already know this, so if it's going to be boring, raise your hand and tell me. there's a verb here that's translated in the New Revised Standard Version as till, okay? To till the soil. For the Lord had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no one to till the ground. Or in verse 15, the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. Interestingly, the word that means till, abad, in Hebrew, typically in other uses means to serve. Okay? It's quite proper to translate it as till here. But we need to realize that in other places in the Hebrew Scriptures, other places in the Pentateuch, when you read abad, it means to serve. This tells us something very important about what it means to till. It doesn't mean to take a plow and make a scar on the surface of the earth, right? It means to serve the earth, right, in one's farming of it. Second thing we need to notice, getting back to the point about Adam, human being is created not out of dust, and unfortunately we use this on Ash Wednesday, you are dust, and to dust you shall return, right? Well, the word here is not dust, okay? It is a word that means arable soil, humus. Humus, humus. Like you have in your garden, like you find on the paths when you're walking around, over toward Ten Mile Falls and Monkey Bear. This very rich compost made of decaying organic matter, which is nourishing. Okay? So the human being is created not out of dust, not out of something worthless or left over, but out of exactly what sustains. And so it might be more appropriate to see Adam, right, is created out of humus, is a farmer in a way, a carer, a server of the earth, a tiller of the soil. We are one with the soil that sustains us. And there's a marvelous recent quote from Timothy Weisgill: there is no such thing as a post-agricultural society, right? We all still need to eat. We all still need the soil. And so we are essentially tillers of the soil, but servers of the earth, you get here. So we're of the same stuff as creation, and we're also equally dependent on the breath of God as the rest of creation for our sustenance. Yes?
Yeah, for that word, I mean, you're right about till meaning serve. Perhaps in English, one word with the kind of wordplay that might help, I've sometimes used, is the word cultivate. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, cultivate, obviously you cultivate the soil, but you also cultivate a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's fostering, enhancing, nurturing things. You cultivate your children as you help them grow. So that, I mean, obviously it's not meant to be an exploitative term at all, but,
right,
but a term of nurture and growth.
Right. I like that because it's a word that combines the meanings better than either of those two. So there is this sense that we are cultivating, serving, and also one with what we are working. And we are that way quite literally because we have to eat from it, right? So there's this wonderful tradition in Genesis 2, which is a very different image of the human being. Instead of saying, if we have a dividing line, God up here, stuff down here, Genesis 1 puts us above the line with God, Genesis 2 puts us below the line with stuff, okay? And it's probably good to have that sort of stereo, right? And what we have tended in Christian history to forget about is the second half, which is maybe why we need to overemphasize it a little. There are also other places to draw on. The goodness of all creation. Where are some places we could find the goodness of all creation? In especially the Hebrew scriptures, but also the New Testament. Where are some passages you might look if you wanted to see not just the goodness of humanity, but the goodness of all creation?
The Psalms, again, I mean, that's Old Testament. But...
The Psalms are great,
yeah.
Right. In what, you got a particular one in mind?
I'm just trying to remember, I think it's 136 or something like that.
Let's take a look.
Verse 3.
That's a good one. Do you want to read maybe just the first several? We have to get past verse 3, but maybe the first down to 9 would be great. That's a good one. It might be. Starting with 4? Is that?
It wasn't the one I got.
Oh, okay.
The one talks about bless the Lord. I guess I just found it.
104.
Mm-hmm. 104 is a good one, which it was one I had in mind. 136 is good too. It was especially, there. 104 is good, the whole thing. 14, for instance, you cause the grass to grow for the cattle and plants for people to use, to bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the human heart, oil to make the face shine, and bread to strengthen the human heart. But then, the trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. In them the birds build their nests. The stork has its home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the conies. You have made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness and it is night when all the animals of the forest come creeping out. And then near the end, near 27, they all look to you to give them their food in due season. when you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. So, and God's works are manifold. In God's wisdom, God makes the whole world, and some of it has nothing to do with us. God makes homes for the animals and sort of regions for them, this suggests, for them to be in. Okay? We have our realm, and they have theirs, right? There are also wonderful passages in Job. I'll just read a little bit from Job 38. Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring the rain on a land where no one lives, on the desert which is empty of human life, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground put forth grass? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? God sends rain where human beings are not, right? For other beings, not for us. God is not there just for us, right? God is there for all of creation. And also, Job 40 is a wonderful place to look. Verse 15, look at Behemoth, which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Strength is in its loins, and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are knit together. Its bones are tubes of bronze, its limbs like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with the sword. For the mountains yield food for it where all the wild animals play. Under the lotus plant it lies, in the covert of the reeds and in the marsh. The lotus trees cover it for shade. The willows of the wadi surround it. Even if the river is turbulent, it is not frightened. It is confident, though Jordan rushes against its mouth. Can one take it with hooks or pierce its nose with a snare? This creature is greater than you are. Right? This creature is what is being said at this point. Right? This creature is something that God has created. It is beautiful. It is powerful. And you don't have power over it, actually, right? It is something that is great in its own right, and beautiful and strong. And God has created it and wishes you to honor it as well, right? And then, finally, we have Matthew, which can be read in many ways. Matthew 6. But is helpful to us, I think, also. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And can any of you stop by worrying at a single hour to your span of life? And why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Okay. This is, on one side, this is, don't worry, be happy. Sorry, I have faith in God. On the other side is, look how much God cares for the rest of the world. Look how much God values the rest of the world. And this is important because this is in the particularly Christian scriptures, right? Not just in the Hebrew scriptures. All is good. All is loved by God. All is part of God's design. All depends on God, and all is interdependent. Okay? And there's a sense in all of these of honoring God's greater power and imitating God's care and respect for creatures. There's a smallness of the human being in these passages that doesn't quite come out in Genesis 1 and in the first psalm that we read.
I found the one that I was thinking of. It's actually Psalm 148, which I think is used at the Easter Vigil. Look at verse 3. Praise him, sun and moon. Praise him, all you shining stars. Praise him, you highest heavens and you waters then down to verse 7, praise the Lord from the earth, you sea monsters and all deeps, fire and hail, snow and frost, stormy wind fulfilling his command, mountains and all hills, fir trees, cedars, wild animals, cattle, creeping things, flying birds, so on. So it's such a great image of creation giving praise as a witness
right.
for us.
Right. Yeah. It is. And the design, because the verses you didn't read, he commanded and they were created. He established them forever. He fixed their bounds, which cannot be passed. Right? So this is a wonderful song that you've picked out that is about God's design, the goodness of creation. There is no doubt after reading all of these passages, the expansion of the human that happens in Genesis 1 and in Psalm 8 gets pulled in these passages, right? We're not so big. We're not so big at all in this design. There's another point, and this will be coming out Thursday, I think. So probably we shouldn't dwell on it too much now. What do you think of when you think of Sabbath or Jubilee? Biblical images or traditional images, what is Sabbath and Jubilee about for you?
Release.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Release.
Restoration.
Restoration. Okay. To get it down to really basic terms, what is Sunday about in your life?
Worship and
rest. Worship. Rest. Right. Some of us are not so lucky anymore as to be able to rest on Sunday, right? Here we try. Worship and rest. And so we think of it in terms of our activity, of human activity. What about Jubilee? Thoughts about memories of what Jubilee entails?
Forgiving
debts, right? And there was something else?
No, that's what I was saying.
Okay, right. Forgiving debts. So it has a lot to do with relationships between human beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else comes up when you think of Jubilee and Sabbath?
The land lies fallow.
The land lies fallow, right. So when we remember Jubilee and Sabbath, we tend to remember a lot of the social justice things, a lot of the personal rest things, a lot of the personal renewal things. But when we look at Jubilee and Sabbath in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, it's also about the land and the animals and the plants. Okay. We look at Leviticus 25, and we'll actually be reading this later in the week. One through seven. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you, the land shall observe a Sabbath for the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath, you, your male and female slaves, your hired and your bound laborers who live with you, for your livestock also and for the wild animals in your land. All its yield shall be for food. Okay? And then it goes on to explain the Jubilee, the 50th year, which is an extra Sabbath, right? An extra special Sabbath. And this has to do with returning what was owed, paying debts, everyone returning to sort of square one. But what is the rationale for this? We have to look at verse 23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land. Now, I doubt your local taxing body sees your house as belonging to God or the land that it sits on, right? But this is very clear. You don't own it, right? It belongs to God. And here we get a sense then of it not belonging to us. We also get an understanding of the land as participating in the new creation, in renewal and redemption. Isaiah is a famous place to get this in chapter 11. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and the little child shall lead them. Right? Sense of all the species being in harmony. The cow and the bear shall graze, and their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand in the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So there's the sense that a time of redemption, a time of renewal includes everything, that it's not us being lifted up out of that yucky, deteriorating matter, and we get saved out of it and taken back to the light. It's that the whole world participates in redemption. I want to point forward to a little problem, though, that we need to deal with in Christian thought if we really believe this. So here I'll be pointing to a passage as a challenge to be taken up. Saturday we'll be doing that. But it's worth thinking about. Okay, Romans 8, starting at verse 18. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly while we wait for adoption and the redemption of our bodies. What would it mean for the creation to be freed from the bondage to decay if we ourselves are created out of the decay? Something to think about. And something to remind us that there are many, many, many theologies going on in the Bible that we need to sort out. So that's a seed to plant for the end of the week. So we have those pieces. We also have some very interesting things going on in the Hebrew Bible. Does God destroy? In the accounts in the Hebrew Bible. Does God destroy anything?
No.
Okay.
Yep.
Where's the yep coming from?
When he opens up the earth and installs a bunch of the Israelites at Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
And Sodom and Gomorrah.
Okay.
And he threatens it in Nineveh.
Okay. And the other places?
The flood narratives.
The flood narratives. Okay. So we have images of God destroying here. Okay.
That's our interpretation.
That's our interpretation.
Of destroying.
Right.
It's not God destroying. It's our interpretation as to what's good for us as to what God is doing.
Right. There's this sense that God is But there's a sense in the authors that God has destroyed something, right? And that we have read it that way. The idea that God has destroyed, that God destroyed what God made is certainly there in the flood narratives. Although God does it arbitrarily. Does God destroy arbitrarily? In the stories in which God seems to be destroying, is God destroying arbitrarily? Usually just sort of randomly?
That's a plan. No.
No. But as a response to
evil?
As a response to people who have sinned, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the flood narratives anyway, God at the end of it, however, makes a promise, right? That God will not destroy again. And we get that in Genesis 9. We have something that sounds very much like the beginning of even as a new authority, because in Genesis, too, in the first chapters of Genesis, humanity doesn't have permission to eat of the animals, right? God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth, and on every bird of the air, on everything that creeps in the ground, and on all the fish in the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you." And he goes on, and be fruitful and multiply, abound on the earth and multiply in it. And then in chapter 7, in verse 17, God said to Noah with the rainbow, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." Okay? And in 11, "I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." So this is a place in which God is saying, "I will not act in these ways." There's something else interesting about destruction in the Old Testament. And from what we know about the history of not just biblical biblical era, but early classical civilizations, the destruction that happens that is attributed to God often turns out to have a quite different cause. Okay? And we can get little hints of this in Deuteronomy and Hosea and Jeremiah. And this may help us connect the two images that we have of God going in Genesis. I'm going to skip over Deuteronomy because it's getting late, but we could go to Hosea chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. "Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or loyalty, and no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, and murder, and stealing, and adultery break out. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns, and all who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air. Even the fish of the sea are perishing." Okay. Bloodshed follows bloodshed. We think on a large scale what's happening. We're thinking not just somebody having a drunken brawl here, right? This also implies war. Okay. What is the result of war on the landscape?
Devastation.
Destruction, right? Because not only are people not planting, they are burning, they are having to forage because they haven't planted, okay? Contention on a large scale always yields environmental destruction. And this is a hint of what we've got going on here in Hosea. Is it God that is coming down and causing the world to bite back? Well, not really, right? We get the sense that this is something that human beings are doing that is causing the world to bite back. Jeremiah chapter 4, I'm just going to look at a little bit of it. 23 through 28 is the strongest place. I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and lo, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and lo, there was no one at all, and all the birds of the air had fled. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all its cities were laid in ruins, before the Lord, before his fierce anger. For thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be a desolation, yet I will not make it a full end. Because of this, the earth shall mourn, and the heavens above grow black. For I have spoken, I have purposed, I have not relented, nor will I turn back. Okay, we know from archaeological and historical data that one of the reasons for desolation in the Mediterranean area were, for instance, when there was too much deforestation, there would not be enough rain. Okay, there would be erosion. Turning from the laws of God, which have to do with Jubilee, which have to do with agriculture, and not only with relationships between people, turn out to be destructive to the landscape. And this is more like parental use of consequences to teach children. When we were on our way here, we stopped in Wenatchee, and the church in Wenatchee has a wonderful ministry of putting teaching staff up and getting them to Fields Point. And we were staying with a family there who has a lovely Castle Rock right behind their house. You can hike up there, but it's very loose all the way up, very difficult footing. Four of us had on our hiking boots, and our 13-year-old decided that she did not need to wear hers. She went up in a pair of Adidas's and almost couldn't make it because of the difficult footing on almost smooth shoes. Teaching by consequences. If you don't follow the rules, you'll get into trouble. And she kept sliding down all of this loose rock. Similarly, we can look at these Old Testament passages in Jeremiah and Hosea and various other places, Deuteronomy, as indications of the consequences of not following the law of God, which is to fit into the rhythm and the limits that are built into the structures around us. Now, this is a strange thing to hear, I think, in the Lutheran context, because if you had to organize law and gospel on this little chart we made, where would you put them? Gospel law, right? I mean, forget about the law. The law is over. The law is useless, right? Except that we don't read Martin Luther carefully enough. Luther didn't say, get rid of the law. He said, realize the law won't get you to heaven. Realize the law is not a path to salvation. The law may not be, in Luther, a path to salvation, but the law is a guide for daily life. The law is a discipline, and the law is a way to fit into the structures of creation, the orders of creation that exist in our world. Okay? So that we can look at the laws of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the laws that encompass Jubilee and care of the land and attention to the creatures around us, right? As laws in the second sense that tell us how the world works and guidelines for us to conform to. One of the interesting things about this is that in the Christian tradition, especially if we read Paul, we tend to think of the law as something outside of us and imposed upon us. What some of these passages teach us is that the law is something that is in us. as biological beings in an ecological environment. Okay? And faithfulness to God requires attending to that and conforming ourselves to it, knowing that creation works by its particular rules and can either work with us or bite us back, right? And that this is something in the structure of creation. So the Bible tends to put human beings at the middle, but there are many, many passages in it that put us at the periphery, or at least as one among many, that we can draw on. Can we get rid of dominion? What do you think? What do we do with dominion?
I think we're stuck with it.
Because we think.
Because we can't survive much differently than we traditionally have over the last 3 or 4 or 5 thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
We're not equipped to do that. Well, we haven't equipped ourselves to do that.
Doesn't the New Testament refocus the emphasis on this whole notion of this image into one of stewardship? We're focusing in on being good stewards of the gifts of creation that have been entrusted to our care, as opposed to land owners who can do
right. What
we choose.
Right. Stewardship has been one way of transforming dominion. Right? Of softening it, of making it a responsibility given to us. Yeah.
Well, I think another thing that along the lines of not being able to escape it is that inaction we understand now to be a choice, so that if we choose not to do, we are making a choice about something, so our will, our free will extends beyond what we do to what we don't do. And so we can't really say we're going to, for instance, manage a forest by not touching it.
Mm-hmm.
Because by not touching it, we might be depriving it of something that it needs to be, like fire on these east side forests.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
For the people of the Old Testament who lived under the law, dominion was just the natural extension of the law. Because if the people are living under the law, then they will not abuse the dominion that they have. But for the people of the New Testament that don't live under the law anymore, or there's more responsibility there.
Mm-hmm.
With not being bound by the law anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why stewardship is necessary, because then with dominion, the law keeps us in our place with the power that we have. But once we have the responsibility to do anything we want to, then we need stewardship to be able to keep things in check.
We need some ideas, some checks, right? Some values.
We need to check ourselves,
right?
Instead of having God do it for us.
In a sense, you're right, yeah.
And don't you think we need education and understanding?
Exactly.
We still come to think of the world as ours.
Right, and we need to know how it works in order to respect the way it works, right? Yeah.
Christy, one place where near where we were reading, I noticed that the word understanding was used, it wasn't in the verse we were reading, but the word understanding was used in describing the creation, that God's understanding was manifest in different things and not.
Right. I think that was that Psalm 136, was that?
Yeah.
We almost read it, but we didn't.
Yeah, but I think we didn't get to that piece of it.
Yeah. That's a good one. Because it's. Oh, no, wait a minute.
That
was something else.
That's
sorry.
Right. I'm struggling to find it.
Right. Now I can't find it either. All
I'm
right.
Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. So, yes, there are those, the understanding And that's where participation and the rationality in the mind of God comes in, right? A capacity that we have to understand, and a responsibility that we have to understand. It also helps us draw together and perhaps understand a little bit more what it would mean to follow a law in a way that was not enslaving, right? To be a slave to the law is to say, oh my gosh, I better not break any rules because otherwise I'll get in trouble, right? Which is not generally the biblical understanding of law in the Pentateuch, okay? The biblical understanding of law has more to do with living a life that is coherent with the patterns of creation that God has created for us, okay? Living a life that coheres with those structures and with the relationships God wants us to establish with the rest of creation. What those are bigger questions, right? But the law as, therefore, something which is built into us, biologically almost, and which we out of love for God and for the creation which God loves can follow. Okay, I know it's time to end. Some of you might not need to go to Narnia, but I do. So I invite
you
to
continue reading. If you would
continue
like
reading.
Liberty to stay a little bit more, I would be happy to grab your kids.
Thanks. I think I have to check them out unless I tell them otherwise.
Oh.
So I appreciate that. I'm going to go and collect my kids. Thank you very much for coming. And for your thoughts around these passages.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And please feel free to pick up a resource sheet. Fortunately, again, I'm afraid it smells like bug spray, but maybe it will be helpful.
And does this have the different references that we talked about?
No, it doesn't.